Well, it's now time for our featured segment. It is time for Mic Check as we close out African History Month, Black History Month, as some call it. This morning, ladies and gentlemen, the conversation is going to be about the Reconstruction era in Alabama, the Montgomery bus boycott, its association with the civil rights movement, ladies and gentlemen. And then we're going to end the presentation this morning, an American pioneer, Miss Claudette Colvin, her role in the civil rights movement. Joining us this morning, Anthony, is an American historian. His name is Dr. Richard Bailey. Please introduce the guest, Anthony.
Yes, Ross Clemmer, special guest on my check, as you said this morning. His name is Dr. Richard Bailey, and he's a renowned American historian, best known for his work on the Reconstruction era in Alabama and its African-American leaders. He has authored several books on the subject, including Neither Carpet Baggers Nor Scalawags, which was chosen as a supplemental school text by the Alabama School Board of Education, making him the only the second African-American author to receive this honor in the state. In addition to his writing, Dr. Bailey has played an active role in preserving historical sites and establishing historical markers. Bailey is a native of Alabama and is the youngest of 12 children. He attended Booker T. Washington High School, and he earned his PhD from Kansas State University. So we welcome Dr. Bailey to Groovin' Radio this Saturday morning.
Good morning, Dr. Richard Bailey. How are you this morning, sir?
I'm fine, and good morning to you also.
As I welcome you to Groovin' Radio this Saturday morning, you are down there in Alabama. How is Alabama this Saturday morning, sir?
Well, Alabama is showcasing about 72 degrees, overcast skies, but it's warm for a February. Usually the temperature is not quite this high in February.
Indeed. Now, as we close out African History Month, Black History Month, and we know how important this month is, really. Every day is important for us, Dr. Bailey. But a person like you who grew up in the heart of the South, what was it like growing up in the time you grew up in Alabama? And that's where we're going to start, Dr. Bailey.
Surely. I grew up in the 1950s and the 1960s in Montgomery, Alabama, and as most people know, Montgomery is the capital city. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, every aspect of life was segregated. Mm-hmm. The school system was segregated. Mm-hmm. The churches were segregated. Entertainment was segregated. Mm-hmm. The cemeteries were segregated. All walks of life was segregated. Mm-hmm. Segregation was the order of the day. And I want to add, segregation was rigidly enforced.
How far you think we have come today? Because you're still in the South. You're still in Alabama. How far you think we have come today, Dr. Bailey? Huh?
We have come a long way in many ways. Mm. But in some ways, we have not come far. I don't think there's any African-American who will tell you in 2023 that he or she will be called the N-word. I don't think that will happen. Mm. I don't think that any white person would acknowledge discriminating against an African-American. And I think that for the most part, an African-American can purchase a house in a formerly segregated neighborhood, mm-hmm. can go to the banks and get a reasonable interest rate on a loan. But in many instances, times have not changed. Still, there are doors that are closed to African Americans, but the public acknowledgement of those closed doors is what you might not find. Mm-hmm. In other words, when certain agencies or individuals can find ways to discriminate, not all of them, mm-hmm. but some of them might take the road they should not take and find themselves discriminating.
Mm. You know, as an historian, Dr. Richard Bailey, earlier on you mentioned quite a few things that when you were growing up were just strictly segregated. As you travel the country, and you have a PhD, and this maybe is a question I should ask a white person, but do you think there are any white persons out there, based on how you grew up, do you think there's any white person out there who would trade places with us? Do you think so?
Yes, there are a few, but we're talking about maybe 1% of the population. there are some white persons who identify wholly with the plight of African Americans. I wouldn't want anyone to think for 1 minute that all white people are bad, not by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. Even during the bus boycott and years before that, right here in Montgomery, mm-hmm. Robert Grass was the pastor of the all-black Trinity Lutheran Church. Mm-hmm. His house was bombed 3 times during the bus boycott, with the third bomb not exploding. Mm-hmm. He suffered all kinds of indignities. His wife had difficulties with going to the a white beauty shop, et cetera, et cetera. And then there was Rabbi Seymour Atlas, mm-hmm. who lost his job in one of the Jewish congregations because he appeared on National Brotherhood Week in March 1956 with the Reverend Leroy Bennett, then pastor of the Mount Zion AME Zion Church. And he wrote articles and for the Montgomery Advertiser of a very liberal nature for 1956 and refused to recant his association with African Americans. Mm-hmm. So when we go back, we can find the Clifford Durs, attorney who was serving the Roosevelt administration, who allied himself with Fred Gray in terms of preparing briefs, et cetera, for the Montgomery bus boycott, and his wife, Virginia Durr, who was a good friend of Rosa Parks. Mm. And she, too, identified with the cause of African Americans. So wherever you go, you will find a handful of white individuals who truly, and I want to say truly, identified with the cause and plight of African Americans.
Mm. You know, I can hear Anthony over there buzzing to ask a question, but I want to get into Reconstruction first, Anthony.
Sure.
You work on the Reconstruction era in Alabama. The 50s was bad in the South. The 60s was bad in the South. Talk about Reconstruction and what was that like, coming out of the movement?
First of all, for those persons who may not know it listening to us now, Reconstruction was that period that began immediately after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And when you want to even compare the 1950s with Reconstruction, in many ways, there's no comparison.
Mm-hmm.
When you start talking about the plight of African Americans, many of those persons who could not read nor write,
mm-hmm.
when you're talking about African Americans who had no rights, we sometimes forget that the Civil Rights Act of 1866 became the 14th Amendment. We sometimes forget that slavery was not officially ended mm-hmm. until the 13th Amendment was passed in December 1865.
Mm-hmm.
We sometimes forget that African Americans did not get voting rights across the board in this country until the 15th Amendment was passed in 1870, and African Americans began to get the congressional mandate allowing them the right to vote in March 1867 with the passage of a series of Reconstruction Acts.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is, when we talk about the atrocities that African Americans faced and the difficulties they faced during Reconstruction, there's not a fair comparison with what happened during the 1950s. What happened in the 1950s was terrible,
mm-hmm.
but what happened in the 1860s and 1870 with Klan violence and just this kind of discrimination that African Americans were confronted with,
mm-hmm.
it was terrible in comparison.
Jim Crow wreaking havoc in those days, huh?
Yes. In fact, during the Grant administration, a series of what we call enforcement acts were passed that sought to curtail the activities of the Klan, and some measure the atrocities of the Klan were curtailed, but they were not wiped out. Mm-hmm. But the point of the matter is, what we need to emphasize on the other side of the fence is what did happen during Reconstruction that benefited not only black people, but white people as well. We began to get the rise of black education in the South. Mm-hmm. Many black colleges and universities saw their birth during Reconstruction.
Indeed.
Black banks, black labor unions. And if you just look at the dates for many of our black churches, they really sprang up during Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Some cities in Alabama were established during Reconstruction. Birmingham, for example, Gaston, for example, and many other schools were established during Reconstruction. So what happened during Reconstruction didn't just benefit African Americans, it benefited the society at large also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the voice of an American historian. His name is Dr. Richard Bailey. As we close out African History Month, Black History Month, we're looking back at he worked on the Reconstruction era in Alabama. We're going to be talking about the Montgomery bus boycott. But Anthony, you have a question for Dr. Bailey.
Well, good morning, Dr. Bailey.
Yes,
I'm not going to say I'm the most knowledgeable about this era, but when I was doing a little research, and you spoke about what happened in 1867, and I'm told that the Republican-dominated Congress took control of the Reconstruction process, and they really had attempted to expand and protect the civil rights of people enslaved. Can you just elaborate a little bit about the difference between both, and you know how it impacted people who were enslaved?
The role of the political parties.
Well, the two eras that we're talking about, presidential reconstruction congressional reconstruction.
Right. Well, first of all, we're talking about a flipping of the political parties. During the 19th century, for African Americans, 1867, it was the Republican Party that was the ally of African Americans. The Democratic Party was considered the party of former slaveholders, and for the most part, the Democratic Party was the opponent of black change. And then during the 1960s, the 1950s, it was the Democratic Party that was the ally of African Americans, especially in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
But I would want to hasten to make one point.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Earl Warren was appointed by President Eisenhower to the United States Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
The story is told how President Eisenhower regretted having appointed the former California governor to the United States Supreme Court. But it was because of Earl Warren that we got the Brown decision that essentially overturned the Plessy decision of 1896. The Brown decision of 1954-1955 overturning the separate but equal tenets of Plessy versus Ferguson of 1896.
Mm-hmm.
But during Reconstruction, we received many congressional measures that actually advance the cause of African Americans in this country. But the point of the matter is, the bottom line in terms of your question, during Reconstruction, it was a Republican Party. Those persons who felt an allegiance to the party of Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, that gave us our advancements. And then during the 1960s especially, we're talking about the Democratic Party with such presidents as John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson. But we don't want to forget the Voting Rights Act that was passed during the administration of President Dwight Eisenhower also.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we go back down to Alabama, Montgomery.
Surely.
In the history of Montgomery, Dr. Bailey, what are some of the key events and individuals that are significant to black history? And how did they help to shape the city? Huh?
Well, first of all, there are several persons who play key roles in advancing the cause of African Americans in this city. Mm-hmm. Some of those persons, the names you might not hear as readily as some others, Reverend Solomon Say Sr., E.D. Nixon, Rosa Parks, a person whose name come to mind immediately when we talk about Montgomery in the early 1950s. And then beginning in 1950s, especially 1954, we began to add such names as Attorney Fred D. Gray and Martin Luther King Jr.
Now, the bus boycott, and this is a burning subject matter when it comes to the movement, the civil rights movement, the Montgomery bus boycott, and how it's got, what sparked it and everything. And you know, there is an American pioneer that has been almost written out of the history of the movement. And her name is Claudette Colvin, who's still alive. Do you know Claudette?
Yes.
Do you know Claudette Colvin, Dr. Bailey?
I don't know her. I've never met her. She left Montgomery during my early years. I have met her sister, Gloria Laster, who lives in Birmingham. Even to this day, I met her about 20 years ago. But I have never met Claudette Colvin, but I certainly know who she is because I have written about her and I have talked about her. And I just want to add that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and his family lived one half block from where I grew up in Montgomery, Centennial Hill. But I never met him and never knew him because he left Montgomery in 1960 when I was quite young.
Before we talk about Claudette Colvin, what was the bus boycott like? What was it like back then? Paint a little picture for our listening audience to understand where, how far we have come and where we came from. What was that like back then for you as a young person growing up?
Well, first of all, there were no black bus drivers. That's the first point that I would want to emphasize. No black bus drivers. The second point I would want to emphasize is that bus drivers, not all of them, but too many of them, were most discourteous to black passengers. Black passengers boarded the bus, paid their fares, exited the bus, and re-entered the bus from the side door. In too many instances, those buses drove away, leaving those passengers who had paid their fares standing. Sometimes it might be raining, sometimes it might be cold. But they were at the mercy of circumstances. They were called all sorts of names. In other words, their treatment was most discourteous. They were not treated well at all on city buses. And that's the kind of climate that African Americans, many of whom had no vehicles of their own to provide their transportation, were forced to depend on public transportation for getting to the downtown area and getting to their jobs.
You know, most of our listeners, or some of our listeners, might not know the role of Montgomery, the city of Montgomery, it plays in the civil rights movement. Can you speak on that a little for us, Dr. Richard Bailey?
Certainly. First of all, bus drivers had police powers. Bus drivers could enforce segregation laws. The first 10 seats on the local buses were reserved for whites and whites only. That is to say, if a black person boarded an empty bus, that black person still could not sit in those first seats that were reserved for whites. Not only that, those middle seats were, shall we say, in the neutral zone, but the last 10 seats were reserved exclusively for black people. But here's something else that many people don't focus on. It was also against the law for a white person and a black person to occupy seats along the same bench. That was illegal also.
So what would happen, Dr. Bailey? What would happen if a black person go on a bus in the neutral zone and sat beside a white person? What would happen?
Well, first of all, the driver would ask that black person to take his or her seat in the black section. If the black person refused to do so, the bus driver would call the police, and that person would be arrested for violating the city segregation laws.
Mm. Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the voice of an American historian and author, Dr. Richard Bailey, who grew up in Montgomery, Alabama, still there in Montgomery, Alabama, helped to work on the Reconstruction era in Alabama. We're talking now about the Montgomery bus boycott. Were you leery? Were you timid when you were growing up? What were your thoughts growing up in that era, Dr. Bailey? Were you worried?
Well, actually, most African-American were not necessarily worried because, for example, in my case, I seldom met a white person. The town was so rigidly segregated, you only encountered a white person when you went into the downtown area. So if you went to a black school, lived in a black neighborhood, attended a black church, you only saw white people in the newspapers if you read a newspaper or on television.
Wow.
You met them when you went to the stores downtown, or if a white merchant operated a store in your neighborhood. Outside of that, you did not see white people.
Can you paint a picture for us then? What was the conversation like back then in your household? What kind of conversations the families were having back then regarding the state of America?
Well, first of all, that would have been grown folks talk, and you were not privy to what grown people would be talking about. But I can just imagine that many black people just made certain they stayed out of harm's way.
Mm.
And here's what I'm saying. I do remember growing up, my mother had a friend who attended the mass meetings, and many times that friend would stop by the house to abreast my mother of what might have happened at a mass meeting. But my parents did not attend mass meetings, and certainly we were too young to attend mass meetings. But I can tell you something that relates directly to your point.
Mm.
Whenever a black kid left home in those days, the chances are great that black kid was walking.
Mm-hmm.
The parents cautioned those black kids to be careful, to stay out of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we heard all the time. Stay out of trouble. Be careful.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never knew when something might happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of the matter is, for a long time, Montgomery was without a black attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the likes of a Fred Gray and a Charles Langford and some others who were our early black attorneys during the 1950s, not our first one, but there was a void for a long time when the city did not have one.
Mm-hmm.
Mahalia actually Dickerson came here in 1948, mm-hmm. but she didn't stay that long. But before that, there were many years that passed since the previous black attorney had been here in town. So basically, we did not have too many black attorneys, even when I was growing up here in Montgomery. But times were difficult, and even if you had a black attorney, when you went into the courtroom, that black attorney might not receive courteous treatment. He might not receive cooperation from the court, and he had to go beyond the call of duty in defending his black clients.
Wow. Wow. You were still able to earn a PhD coming out of that era. You were still able to earn a PhD. How difficult was that? Final question in this segment.
Yes. Well, first of all, I earned my PhD from Kansas State University, which is not exactly in the South. But mm-hmm. I will tell you mm-hmm. something that was quite beneficial for me. Two things in particular. I was able to teach a black history course at Kansas State University, and I invited Attorney Charlie Scott, to come to speak to my integrated class.
Mm.
Charlie Scott had been Linda Brown's attorney, as in Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas.
Mm.
And I should never forget, after the class, we walked over to the Union Building, and I said to Attorney Scott, is there anything that you and Thurgood Marshall and Constable Baker Motley would have changed in arguing the Brown decision Without any hesitation, he said, yes, we did not ask for integration. We asked for the enforcement of the Plessy decision. I should never forget that. The other thing is, I am eternally grateful for the topic that I was able to research for my dissertation, and that topic became my carpetbag of book. When my professor asked me to research those black office holders who had served Alabama during Reconstruction. A difficult topic at the time, but a most beneficial one I learned later.
I am eternally grateful, Dr. Richard Bailey, to have you on Grooving Radio this Saturday morning speaking to our listening audience. Many of the things that you're saying, it is the first time most people listening to this presentation are hearing it. So I am eternally grateful that you are able to join us this Saturday morning. We're going to take a 3-minute break, Dr. Bailey. Stay where you are. When we come back, I want to talk about the role of this American pioneer, Claudette Colvin, her role she played, her part she played in the civil rights movement that sparked the Montgomery bus boycott. My name is Ras Clem, and this is Grooving Radio. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, folks, the history lesson, the AP history lesson, continues here on Grooving Radio. Stay where you are, ladies and gentlemen.
It's powerful, it's informative, it's educational with lots of thought-provoking conversations. Yes, it's Groovin' Radio, Saturday morning 9 to 11:30 and Sunday evening 6 to 8, right here on 93.5 WVIP, hosted by Ross Clem. Join the Groovin' Radio experience and stay one step ahead.
Blessed love, this is Dwayne Stevenson from Augustown, and anytime I find myself in a New York state of mind, you know I always tune in to Groovin' Radio, night or day, I so we play it. Keep it moving.
And thank you so much, my little brother, Mr. Dwayne Stevenson, for bringing us up at this 11 o'clock moment, the final 25 minutes of the Grooving Radio's experience presentation. We are in our featured segment. It is called Mic Check. It is History Lesson 101 right here on Grooving Radio. Our very special guest this Saturday morning. And when I say special, he is indeed a very special individual, an American historian, Dr. Richard Bailey, the man who helped work on the Reconstruction era in Alabama, ladies and gentlemen. He grew up in the South in the moment of the civil rights movement and also the Montgomery bus boycott. Anthony Turner, who is a writer, our writer, is also a part of the conversation. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Yes, thank you.
Now, Dr. Bailey, before we took the break, I mentioned that we want to talk about this American pioneer. This American pioneer who, for some, has been written out of the civil rights movement. But as a young girl at 15 years old, and you have written extensively on her, she took a seat on a bus in the South, refused to give up her seat. Her name is Claudette Colvin. Let's talk about Claudette Colvin and what that moment meant for the movement, the civil rights movement, and the bus boycott.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, sir.
First of all, Claudette Colvin was a 15-year-old student here in Montgomery, Alabama, at the Booker T. Washington School. Mm. And on that day, she and some of her classmates boarded the bus not far from the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. And when the bus left the square in downtown Montgomery, mm-hmm. she had been asked to give up her seat, and she refused to do so, citing her constitutional rights. Mm-hmm. And one point I want to add is that Claudette Colvin was not sitting in the white section of the bus, mm. but according to local segregation laws, anytime the driver instructed a black passenger to do something, that black passenger was compelled to do exactly what that bus driver had instructed her to do. Mm. So on that particular day, several other persons gave up their seats. Mm. but Claudette Colvin refused to do so. Mm. She had heard her teachers at Booker T. Washington School talk about the likes of Harriet Tubman, mm-hmm. Sojourner Truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also had talked about the likes of Edgar Allan Poe and his favorite work, Annabelle Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So she was armed with defiance.
Mm.
She was armed with determination.
Mm-hmm.
She was armed with self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
That's what came to the fore that day when bus driver Claire asked her to give up her seat.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we hear about the Alabama bus boycott, the name that rings out loud is Rosa Parks. But Claudette Colvin was before Rosa Parks. Huh, Dr. Bailey?
That is correct. We're talking about March the 2nd, 1955, mm-hmm. with Claudette Colvin. We're talking about December 1st, 1955, with Rosa Parks.
Mm-hmm.
But here's one point I want to emphasize, mm-hmm. that many people have not come to grips with.
Mm-hmm.
It is incumbent upon the historian,
mm-hmm.
to tell the truth.
Indeed.
The whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Indeed.
And there is no reason, no reason at all, that Claudette Colvin's role should have been minimized.
Hmm. Why do you think Claudette's role was minimized, Dr. Richard Bailey? Why?
Well, yeah, thank you. There are several reasons. First of all, Claudette Colvin's posture was not the kind of posture that many persons in the black community would have wanted to rally behind. She left the bus screaming, kicking, and some other things. And secondly, a little while later, Claudette Colvin became pregnant. And for that reason, she was not considered a kind of role model to become the face of defiance here in Montgomery. And secondly, Claudette Colvin lived in the King Hill community, not one of the most cherished communities in Montgomery.
Mm.
Whereas, even though Rosa Parks lived in the housing project, but the housing project at that time, it still did not have the kind of image that living in King Hill had in the minds of many people. And at the same time, Rosa Parks was secretary to Edgar D. Nixon, who was president of the local chapter of the NAACP.
Mm. Anthony?
Yeah. You have an interesting story, and as you said, the truth has to be told. But having lived in Alabama for most of your life, Doctor, can you just kind of compare and contrast what you saw growing up as a kid and contemporary Alabama, what it looks like today?
Well, first of all, the Montgomery I grew up in is basically, there's no comparison to the Montgomery of today. First of all, you have African-Americans who sit on the city council. You have a black police chief. You have black members of the police department who are in administrative positions, high-profile positions. You have a black head of the city county library. You have blacks who serve on the county commission. You have blacks in the legislature. You even have a female African-American congressperson, Terry Sewell.
Mm-hmm.
So the Montgomery of the 1940s and 50s is very different from the Montgomery of 2023 in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, neighborhoods in Montgomery are integrated. You have many blacks who serve in key positions at our local banks. You have many blacks who serve on the board of what had been segregated agencies.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different Montgomery. And I try to tell people there's much to smile about regarding Montgomery, Alabama in 2023.
Indeed, indeed. I want to go back to Claudette Colvin because we did, and I say we, as African-Americans in this country, we did her wrong. We did her wrong, and we must write the right story. And for her to be wiped out of this civil rights movement for the reasons that she was written out of it. And we find today that at times we still treat each other the same way Claudette Colvin was treated. How do we correct this? Because Claudette Colvin is still alive.
That's true.
How do we correct this, Dr. Bailey?
Well, first of all, we can correct it with the media.
Mm-hmm.
The voice media and the print media began to adopt the kind of platform, as I've mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
Tell the truth, the nothing but the truth, and mm-hmm. the whole truth. And don't write polemical pieces where you are judging people.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you write survives 100 years, 200 years, 500 years, once it is written.
Mm.
So we must tell a judicious story. We must give an even-handed account of the past so that people can understand people. That's our job, is to tell stories so that people understand what might have motivated Claudette Colvin to do what she did. And then when we tell the story of what might have motivated her, we begin to include the odds, the climate at the time in that community. But we want to give people, the readers, the listeners, an opportunity to realize that this person was not a lawbreaker in the context of a Claudette Colvin.
Mm.
You broke a law, but that was an immoral law that she broke.
Mm.
She broke a law that Henry David Thoreau would have been proud that she had broken.
Indeed. Indeed. And the fact that she lived with a criminal record until recently. She lived because she was arrested. And she lived with a criminal record into her 80s. People like iconic congressman like John Lewis, the beating he took on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We should never forget a Claudette Colvin. John Lewis took a whipping for situations like these. Have you ever met John Lewis, that iconic congressman, Dr. Bailey?
Yes, I've met him and I've talked to him. And I have several photographs with him,
and I've recognized
him posthumously at least in one ceremony. But the point of the matter is, there is no reason under God's sun that John Lewis, Amelia Boynton, and Jose Williams and Bob Mance and those persons should have had to suffer what they did on that Edmund Pettus Bridge on March 7, 1965.
Mm.
They were American citizens. They were taxpayers. They were persons who had not lost a single constitutional right, but they had lost the right of respect.
Mm.
But there's no reason they should have been beaten on that day, except they were in violation of an immoral law.
Mm. I have one more question.
Yes.
How can the lessons of Black history be applied to contemporary social and political issues such as racial injustice, civil rights, and equality? That's my final question.
Well, first of all, we must have some people who are brave enough to tell the story as it should be told. Secondly, we have to make certain our stories a part of the historical accounts, the history books, the magazine articles, and then we want to ensure that we have questions regarding Black history on ACT tests, on SAT tests, on LSAT tests. That's when you know that your history has been incorporated into mainstream America, when a white kid, when a German kid, a Japanese kid, an Italian kid has to know Black history to get into graduate school, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm. You know, it's funny you said that, because there is an attorney in Philadelphia by the name of Dana King. Dana King actually changed the whole school system in Philadelphia years ago when she said, in order for you to graduate high school, you must do African history. You must do African history. And to see today, Dr. Bailey, the governor of Florida wants to take out AP studies on Black history out of high schools and universities. Isn't that kind of like want to turn back the clock?
It certainly is. And let me just say this. The governor of Florida is probably just one person we know of mm-hmm. who wants to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Just one person we are talking about. But I would go so far as to say there are many persons who would want to make certain that no kid learns about Harriet Tubman, that kid learns about Fannie Lou Hamer, mm. Rosa Parks, Dr. King, Malcolm X, Adam Clayton Powell, mm. Robert Nix of Pennsylvania. There are many school superintendents who might find it convenient, if they could, to just ensure that a black kid and white kids, not just black kids, don't learn about these people.
Mm. As we close out this African History Month, this Black History Month, you know, when we talk about the week of Black History, the month of Black History, one name that we never talk about is a Jamaican by the name of A.J. Rogers. We have never really spoken about A.J. Rogers in depth here. And when we talk about telling the truth and nothing but the truth, we have to include A.J. Rogers in our Black History remembrance, because he was also the spark that light the fire so we could be here celebrating this month.
That's very true. Joel Augustus Rogers, from Superman to Man, World's Great Men of Color, and some of the other books that he wrote, standing on the street corners in Harlem, trying to sell those books. We must include the likes of J.A. Rogers and John Henry Clark and Carter G. Woodson and Charles H. Wesley and some of those other pioneers who battled all sorts of difficulties and opposition to ensure that black people were not only included in the written text, but also respected.
I am so eternally grateful, Professor, Dr. Richard Bailey, to have you on this morning, sharing with our listening audience. It's been a pleasure having you here, sir. But as we close out this morning, how would you encourage? Give us some word of encouragement on how we should celebrate this month when it comes around. And not just celebrate the month of February, but celebrate us as black people. How should we?
Yes, first of all, let me just mention this. One of my favorite quotes is simply this. If you don't know your history, you won't know when you've been disrespected.
Mm.
If you don't know your history, you won't know when you've been disrespected.
Wow.
I would encourage every family to set aside one evening every week to talk, first of all, about family history.
Mm-hmm.
So that these kids will know something about grandparents and great-grandparents and even great-great-grandparents.
Mm.
And then to learn about one's community, learn about one's schools, about one church, and then to learn about our people. And to talk about that in a way that those persons know that we demand respect. And I would encourage every parent to let a kid know you are not inferior to anybody.
And don't live your life in fear.
That's right. Don't lead your life in fear. And then to make certain that our churches have Black History Month observed every week in February and throughout the year, and that our schools observe Black History Month. But the main thing is that we want to make certain that our history becomes a part of the written history of this country, and that we know something about our family history, the history, as I said, of our churches and our communities and our schools. But main point is we want to make certain our history is not neglected nor overlooked.
You know, last week I said something here, and I'm going to repeat myself this week. The real revolution is the evolution of the mind.
That's right.
The real revolution is the evolution of the mind. I am no longer going to live my life in fear. And I've said it many times, who speaks for the voiceless? Who speaks for those who don't have a microphone? We must develop the courage to do things like these, to ensure that the truth and nothing but the truth is told. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Richard Bailey, for joining us.
And thank you. And thank you for having me.
You're very welcome, sir. I am not going to be a stranger to you. You're going to be hearing from me.
Thank you.
You are going to be hearing from me, Dr. Richard Bailey, an American historian, ladies and gentlemen. Check him out. You can find him on Wikipedia. He is available, ladies and gentlemen, to have conversations with you. Thank you so much, Mr. Bailey.
Thank you.
One love, sir. Anthony.
Yes. I had one more question for Dr. Bailey, a short question still.
I wonder if he's still there. Dr. Bailey, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, just thinking about the importance of ownership of land, real estate, you know, back in those days, and bringing that forward to contemporary America. I want you to just emphasize how important it is, because a lot of our young people are interested in buying fancy cars and all this stuff, and, you know, not really owning a part of the American dream, and real estate in particular.
Yes, first of all, when you purchase that car, the minute you drive off the lot, that car has depreciated in value. When you buy real estate appreciates in value. But not only that, real estate is something that can't be taken away from you unless you don't pay your taxes. And if you really want to know how wealthy you are, start looking at how much real estate you own, and then you can go from there. But the point is, we need to acquire real estate. That's one of the points that many of our 19th century leaders said to us. They asked us to purchase land. Land ownership was very important to those people. Now, I know that during the 19th century, American society was mainly agricultural, especially in the South. Mm. But even today, we don't want our people to, excuse me, minimize the importance of land, and certainly not at the expense of buying a car and buying fancy clothes and other material kind of things.
Indeed, indeed. Dr. Richard Bailey, thank you again, sir, for joining us this Saturday morning. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One love, one love. Ladies and gentlemen, we are at that moment where we're going to have to wrap and make room for the next presentation, which is going to be the Wake Up Radio. What a history lesson this was. And thinking about this, Dr. Bailey mentioned a few times about Brown versus the Board of Education. Think about that. The Supreme Court, today's Supreme Court, wants to take an in-depth look at Brown versus the Board of Education. They're also looking at affirmative action. So pay attention, folks. They really want to turn the clock back. Anthony Turner, thank you
all
so
right.
much.
You take care.
One love. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to close out with my charity corner this morning, giving back to nonprofit as we always do. Once again, let me just quickly remind you that the American Friends of Jamaica, they're getting ready for their March the 11th Jamaica Charity Gala in Florida. They're going to be honoring the Honorable Douglas Rain and also the Honorable Shelley Ann Fraser Price. For more information, please call 212-265-2550. The Manchester High School Global Alumni Network, they're going to be having their homecoming fundraising gala in Jamaica on Saturday, March 25th, 2023. Here is a number that you can call. It's a WhatsApp number, ladies and gentlemen, for more information, 876-278-4470. The Meadowbrook High School Alumni Association, they're getting ready for their 38th annual dinner dance, and they're going to be honoring quite a few people, including myself, Ras Clem, Hyacinth Jocks Jackson, Dr. Carlos Pottinger. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this one takes place on April 15, 2023. For more information, please call Nadine at 847-372-9853. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, the American Foundation for the University of the West Indies, the Afewe Foundation, their 26th annual Legacy Gala. Well, it continues on Thursday, April 20th. Please call Executive Director Miss Anne-Marie Grant at 212-759-9345. That's 212-759-9345. Waiting on the other side of the 11:30 hour, it is going to be the Wake Up Radio team. Groovin' Radio was executively produced by Clement Hume and Christopher Roberts. Groovin' Radio was hosted by Ras Clem, contributing to our presentation over the last 2.5 hours. Got to start off with our musical presentation. We went into Dominica for Nacio Fontaine. We got news, Curtis. Oh, no. In our community engagement segment, Jam Pro Shane Agnes joined us this morning. We got news courtesy of the Jamaica Gleaner, Jamaica Now. Anthony Turner joined us for entertainment segment report, and he provided the bio for our very special Mic Check guest, an American historian, Dr. Richard Bailey. My name is Ras Klem. Ira Jam comes in at 1, Link Up at 6, and Sound Chat at 8. I will see you tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the Wake Up Radio team.